Kion Wolf, you just medaled in the short track half-pipe skeleton ski cross. Was the miscarriage you had last year on your mind?
Miscarriage?
Yes, the miscarriage that you had last year.
I didn't have a miscarriage.
Well, you seemed very emotional about something right at the end there.
I probably got something in my eye. See, in Sochi, the coal ash mixes with the sleet, and it just really gets in there somehow.
It seemed like you were thinking about a deceased loved one.
Oh, no, no.
Somebody you love. Somebody who is now in the next world. You were thinking about... The spirits are asking me to acknowledge the name Tony. Is there a Tony you'd like to speak to?
Are you going John Edward on me, dude? That is so weird.
No, it's just that... Let me tell you a story. When I was young, I had a hamster named Sammy, and we did everything together. And then I went away to college, and my parents called me and said Sammy got sick and had to be put down. And I never...
You never got to say goodbye?
No, I didn't.
How old was Sammy?
14.
Well, that's really old, so it's kind of a lot less sad, but, I can't stop crying about this. He was so little. Did the vet put him down, or...
No, our next-door neighbor had a boa constrictor.
Oh, God, so it was like the circle of life? That's so beautiful.
Kion Wolf, thank you for crying. Now we'll send it back to you, Bob Costas.
Today on the Nose, why does everybody at the Olympics have to cry? Plus, James Franco explains wacky actors and a meditation on the joys of catching a song on the radio. And now, skating to William Shatner's version of Mr. Tambourine Man, Colin McEnroe.
That is my current skating music. All right, she's a good crier, boy. She's gotten better and better.
Weeping myself.
That's right. So before I even introduce the panelists, before I tell you what's happening, I just sort of issue a warning. This is one of those do not adjust your radio warnings. From time to time, you're going to hear me buzz and beep. It'll probably happen 3 times during the show, maybe 4 if we're not lucky. And that's because I'm wearing, from the Clinical Research Department of the University of Connecticut Health Center, a 24-hour blood pressure monitor. So I'm all wired up with it. Every 15 minutes it goes off. And you're going to hear it sounds like somebody's blood pressure is being taken. So if you don't adjust your radio, it's just me. I just wanted to say it before it happened because it's probably going to happen in the next 5 or 10 minutes. It goes off every 15 minutes. All right. So with us is Jim Chapdelaine, producer, Emmy-winning composer, recording engineer, guitarist, everything really, and Luis Figueroa, who's a Trinity College professor and DJ, although not necessarily in that order. It depends on what mood he's in. And Carolyn Payne. That's the other thing I have to do. I have to keep a chart about what mood I'm in when my blood pressure is being taken. And I don't even know what mood I'm in most of the time. I'm not that self-aware. Carolyn Payne, actor, dancer, comedian, writer. And as it turns out, we found out this week, skater, sort of. Towards the end of the show, at least in the second segment, we are going to talk about why does everybody have to cry at the Olympics? What's happening right now? Why does everyone have to cry at the Olympics? Why is NBC so intent on capturing these kinds of moments? Hear it? You hear me? Hear it?
Do you want me to talk in a very calm voice, Colin?
No, because I want to know what my real – I want to know what this show is doing to me.
Right.
I want to know what hosting this show is doing to my
blood
health.
Pressure. Just think what it's doing to listeners.
I want to go right out to the edge with this thing. And we'll also talk about this essay James Franco wrote in the New York Times about why actors behave in wacky ways. And somehow or other managing to link Shia LaBeouf to Marlon Brando, however tenuously. But we're going to start out with an essay called Driving, also from the New York Times, called Driving to the Music of Chance. Luis is the one who suggested this. Oh, I didn't even – did I introduce everybody? Yeah, I did. All right.
Yeah.
You can see I'm distracted and flustered. So Luis is the one who suggested this, although I had read it on Sunday morning, and it kind of set up my day in an interesting way. It's by Beth Boyle Macklin, and it's about she's a mom who has kids in her car, sort of teenage area kids. They're driving around New York, and she has either – because, in fact, the equipment in the car is not that great, and she also just doesn't feel like it for various reasons, she's decided to have commercial radio on in the car. And so she and her kids kind of experience whatever gets served up by the small cluster of stations that they can all agree to listen to. And so she says, usually we flip back and forth between classic rock on Q104.3 and the best of the 60s, 70s, and 80s on 101.1 CBS FM, unless a double dose of Hotel California forces us to seek refuge in the mainstream pop on WPLJ. It's not so bad, really, she writes. My daughters explain who Pink and Fun are, but not why they're called Pink and Fun. And I explain to them, as my parents explained to me, that Creedence Clearwater Revival is singing about a bad moon on the rise, not a bathroom on the right. On a good day, we all learn something. And she also, Beth Boyle McLaughlin, kind of evokes the kind of joy that you get when something you can't control, this isn't your own little playlist that you're maintaining on your iPod or phone or whatever. This is just something that's happening that somebody else, a set of decisions somebody else is making, and then you're kind of lining up with them. And she says, sometimes the green lights line up just right, and we fly down Ocean Parkway, singing along to the glorious chorus of Boz Scaggs' Lido Shuffle. Lido, oh, oh, oh.
That's going to set off my monitor.
That's right. Yeah, there you go. Carrie Fisher's heroine in Postcards from the Edge felt that God was in her car radio and he would play her songs that she liked when he was happiest with her. I'm not sure about God, she writes, but I know when serendipity provides a perfect soundtrack to my life, I get a rare sense of both contingency and convergence. So, Luis, you're a DJ, which implies wanting a certain amount of control over music. So how did this essay resonate and reverberate with you?
Well, first of all, as anyone who grew up listening to a lot of music, in my case in Puerto Rico, I had certain radio stations that I will forever remember. There was Z93 or Z93, which was the leading station in FM for salsa. There was Salsoul 96.5. which mixed salsa at that time in the 70s with disco and funk and boogie. And there were many others. And there was Radio Rock in the AM band for rock music, which I'd also like to listen to. But to me, the essay brought several points, and I'll just start with two in particular. Then we can move to what is today. The first one is the fact that in those days, there were real radio disc jockeys making the selection of the songs for you. Although we know that there was sometimes hanky-panky going on under the table, payola and so on, but there were certain DJs that you followed on particular radio stations who made taste for people, just like DJs in clubs make taste for people in terms of songs. And the other one that I like of her comments was the issue of serendipity, that as she's saying in that last part that you quoted, that you can be all of a sudden thinking about something, have a conversation, you're going through a certain place, and all of a sudden a song comes up that is an appropriate soundtrack for your life. So some of the things that I like, but I want to emphasize the issue of the human intervention of someone helping you discover music.
That is true. And another thing I remember about my own helplessness, and Jim, you and I are the same age, is sometimes it was really hard to figure out even what a song was. I went through a period where I went through about 15 years of trying to figure out what the name of a certain Cat Stevens song was.
Sure, sure.
And so I would say to people, because you'd hear some of it on the radio, and then like one time my college girlfriend, this all was in the 70s, she went into a gas station and it turned off the car just as the DJ was about to say what the song was, and I screamed. And so I spent years going up to people and going, this is Cat Stevens' song, and it's like, now that I was the only part of it I could really come up with. It's called Two Fine People. Please don't write to me and tell me about this. I know what it is now. But it took a long time because all this information was not served up to you in quite the convenient way that it is now.
You know, not surprisingly, I have a lot to say about this, but I will try to condense it. I will say that I think we all had that moment of like being snake bit and thunderstruck when, for me, I remember being like, 10 years old or 8 years old, however it was, and literally having one foot out the door on vacation at my cousin's when I heard The Byrds come on AM radio, and I was frozen. And I already knew about the Beatles, and I thought I was pretty hip, and I wasn't. It just blew my mind. So, and I will also say that the way we used to listen to music was a very communal way. Somebody would get the new Van Morrison album, and you would do Sgt. Pepper's, and you'd run over to their house, and everyone would listen to it. So that moment becomes sort of stamped in time communally. And people consume music very differently, except in the car now. Mm-hmm. And for me, with a 15-year-old also, I've had to surrender to the seven songs that they play over and over again, Imagine Dragons and Katy Perry and Beyonce. And after a while, I get some control and can move it to the lower end of the FM spectrum.
But, you know, Carolyn, one thing, and by the way, if people want to call in and be part of this conversation, you know, what does it mean? What's the difference between having your own carefully curated and maintained playlist, which you can now make pretty portable? So anywhere you want to go, really, you can pop your earbuds on or whatever and just listen to what you wanted, and you can certainly interface your iPod with your car and all that kind of stuff. But and Carolyn's by far the youngest of us, so but I'm assuming this is still a phenomenon that you remember. How much happier you could be if somebody, some radio person somewhere, was playing a song that you liked and wanted to hear. There's some load of happiness that gets delivered there that you can't deliver to yourself just by playing the song for yourself.
Absolutely. I had a similar experience to you where, you know, back I was like in high school and, you know, you'd hear a song on the radio and you needed to know who it was. And I had this horribly embarrassing experience where I went into Tower Records on Newberry Street. I grew up in Boston. And I went up to a guy trying to find this song, which I later found out it just gets more embarrassing. It was like Sugar Ray, I Just Want to Fly. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to describe the song to him. I was like, you know, the song with about flying. And he's like, And then I was like trying to sing it. And I don't sing.
I just want to fly.
And the guy is like, oh, you want that song.
You know, first of all, you subjected yourself to record store condescension. I mean, you know, here's a guy who's making $6 an hour.
I was young and foolish.
Looking at you like you are the dumbest person. Like, oh, the Eagles? Is that for you?
Right.
But it's a double layer. She wants this really dumb song, and she doesn't know how to do
right.
And so, I behaved like an idiot to find it. So.
And this guy just did like a collection of all the obscure Cramps song singles.
But the thing that she describes about her interactions with her kids, I think is an important thing, and it's kind of touching at times in the essay. She says, you know, on the one hand, I sometimes hear my daughter working on her homework, and she's singing My Angel is a Centerfold to herself, you know, and so what have I done here? And on the other hand, she with the same daughter who's into Radiohead and stuff like that, at the end, what comes on? It's an Eagles song that comes on at the end. And it's the Don Henley song, Boys of Summer. Boys of Summer comes on, and she thinks her daughter's going to want to change the radio station, and her daughter goes, oh, no, that's my jam.
Want to add something that is perhaps, you know, obviously it's different in this panel, is that for me, the other element of this experience was coming to the United States as a graduate student in 1982 to, of all places, Madison, Wisconsin, and intent on trying to learn as much English as I could, improve my English, because otherwise I would flunk in graduate school. So one of the things that I would do is I would be, besides I love music, I would be constantly listening to the radio. And the frustration, because this is not my first language, of not being able to understand what the lyrics were saying a lot of times. But at the same time, I remember certain songs and musicians that were from that first fall of 1982 that I discovered on FM radio. Born to Run by Springsteen. There was a song by Pat Benatar. There was a song by Bob Seger. Those I will always forever remember because they were associated with specific moments during that first year.
Dancing in your underwear when your parents had left you alone in the house.
Yes, that's another one.
In the case of Bob Seger.
Yeah, but now we're doing all the reminiscing and the nostalgia and so on. But I, if you don't mind, I'd like to shift it a little bit and to the present. Because in the present, not everything is as bad as people think. It's just you have to rethink how things operate. For example, yes, in an iPod or the iPod function in a cell phone, you have your playlist. But there's also a shuffle function. And one of the things that when Apple was inventing the iPod, that Steve Jobs insisted, was the invention of the shuffle function because you could have a ton of music and you put it on shuffle and it will bring up songs that you have not played in a long time.
That's really the sole thing. I don't use playlists that much on my iPod. I prefer shuffle. And when I'm listening to the radio, I once got made fun of because somebody said, what's your favorite radio station? And I said, Scan. I like to see what's out there. Maybe I'll listen to it for a little.
Yeah, but in terms of the human element that I was mentioning before, I am a big time fan of Spotify. And I pay the premium subscription so I can download songs on my phone and so on. I have a million playlists. But one of the things in Spotify that I like is that you can subscribe to the playlists created by other people. And all of a sudden, you subscribe to some of these playlists and you put them to play, and it's like they're surprising you. They have songs in a particular genre or another that you were not expecting to find, that you would not have, you had not listened to. And so it's a way of democratizing the experience of being a DJ on a radio station. Because anybody can create any playlist, and any user can subscribe to everybody's playlist unless the person declared them private. So I think that the ways in which technology today allows us to do what we used to do, and in fact, sometimes even better. Because in the old days, only a few guys were radio disc jockeys. Now anyone can do that.
Well, let me just say this about the technology. Because obviously we do live in a world of marvels, and Jim probably has like, you know, 87 different music apps on his phone. And so on the same day that Beth's essay came out, by the way, if you want to join this conversation, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. I did go on a long car ride to New York, and we sort of dealt with all these kinds of issues. The person I live with, the mysterious woman that I live with, she likes to listen to the radio. She likes to discover things. She likes that whole quality of serendipity. She doesn't want me jacking my iPod into the dashboard. She wants just to let stuff happen. But anyway, we got home. We spent the day in New York, got home. We were watching Girls on HBO. And at the end of Girls, they usually have some snappy, interesting little indie song that comes on. So this song comes on. So we're listening to this, and we're both thinking, well, that's pretty good. And then we're waiting for the credits at the end, and they don't tell you what the song is. And
that's on HBO.
Yeah.
So I have a whole different take on this.
Well, let me just sort of finish the technology part of this. So then the mysterious woman I live with says, we're watching it on DVR. She goes, back it up. So I back it up. The song plays again. She points her phone at it. She's got Shazam on her phone. And it's really within – it's not even like a full bar,
seconds.
I don't think. Yeah.
Yes.
It's like within just seconds, the Shazam knows that this song is by the Living Sisters. Here's what it is. Would you like to buy it? Would you press this button and it'll be your ringtone? Do this, do that. And that's how fast it is. And in all the ways that Luis is suggesting, unbelievably accommodating at the expense, maybe, Jim, of some mystery or some, you know, some negotiating that we might have had
to do.
No chance of public embarrassment. More
importantly, and this is what we have to talk about in the modern era. And yes, Steve Jobs, it's weird to me that a computer company reinvents the music industry, right? Mm-hmm. So it benefits Luis in many ways because it appeals to his curiosity and it appeals to shuffle. And you don't know how many records I've mastered where I've seen people break down in tears after struggling for hours on the sequence of their album, and me to say, you know, only your friends are going to listen to it exactly as you intended, and then they're going to put it on shuffle. And this is like a big – like musicians want you to listen to it in a very specific order, and that's probably – we inherited that from the days when vinyl had an A side and a B side. Mm-hmm. They were very carefully structured.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of evaporated with shuffle. And that's cool. I'm cool with that. But what I'm not cool with is, say, HBO taking this great song, slapping it on there without giving credit, paying a minimal royalty, maybe $1,500 to those guys for broadcasting national because it's a mechanical license on cable. So they're able to skate by that. And they're saying to the artist, well, you know, you're going to get a lot of hits. Well, this artist is going to get some hits because you're talking about it and it's a really catchy song that sounds like it should be an Apple commercial. But when you get onto to iTunes, they pay 15 cents to the artist mm-hmm. for each purchase. Spotify pays 0.6%.
Mm-hmm.
So 0.6 cents mm-hmm. for each purchase to the artist. Mm-hmm. And Rhapsody pays 0.084 cents. So it's a diminishing return for the artist. So what happens is a strangulation of the artistic community, this pyramid, at which the artist is at the bottom of it, or a totem pole where they're the scrunched up person, and you have artists like Vic Chestnut who are taking their own lives over this. It's the very people who are bringing the pleasure are the people who are being strangulated by this current system.
Well, you know, speaking of pleasure and people, and not to make Carolyn a spokesperson for a generation or like five generations or something like that, but, you know, the other thing, you know, Louise talked about this at the beginning, that we – most of us can kind of remember a time when there were people on the radio who we kind of trusted or engaged with or something like that. If you go far enough back, there are these epic radio personalities like Murray the K, who were given credit for, you know, introducing certain artists to the public and stuff like that. And even now – driving into New York on a Sunday, nothing makes me happier than to get close enough to the New York State line that I can pick up Jonathan Schwartz on WNYC. I mean, Jonathan Schwartz is God if you like a certain kind of thing, you know, and you're listening for Jonathan Schwartz and what he's going to say about this, you know, and what he has picked out. And you know it's Jonathan Schwartz picking this stuff out. But, I'm, you know, I in your lifetime, have there been people like that on the radio, people whose names meant something to you and whose musical choices meant something to you?
You know, I actually don't think so. I was hearing you guys say it. I mean, I guess, you know, when I was like a teenager, I would listen to like Maddie in the Morning on Kiss 108 FM in Boston. You know, I remember listening to him and his antics and, you know, they'd play, obviously.
But what about DJs for your like famous like John Digweed or...
Yeah, I guess I just never really invested that much into that. And then, you know, then I was living in New York, and actually living in New York made me miss radio because in the time that I was living in New York, I never listened to the radio. I would, you know, by then you had like your cell phone had music on it, your iPod, and so I just was kind of I was my own DJ, and I remember thinking how much I didn't hear new music right away always. And it made me glad to have a car to drive around and hear the radio in again. But I don't think that there was a there was no like radio god to me in my lifetime.
But just as a sidebar, The Situation from Jersey Shore made $16 million last year as a DJ, and he was at the low end of it.
Pauly D.
I am in the wrong profession.
Yeah, a lot of professional DJs are waiting for the moment when this guy disappears. You know, and then you also have Paris Hilton.
That's right.
Claiming to be one of the top five DJs in the world.
Now, explain to our listeners what it means to be one of the top five DJs in the world. It doesn't mean what it meant to Cousin Brucey in 1969.
Joey Reynolds.
No. Okay, there are many ways in which this happens. There is a magazine called DJ Magazine that they do this popularity contest every year, and they release the names of the top 100 DJs in the world around the fall. Mm-hmm. And so that's one way of knowing who is hot. But these are not DJs in the way in which the word DJ is normally understood, because what makes these people famous is not that they are mixing songs in a show, is that they produce their own songs.
Mm-hmm.
Calling them DJs is kind of a misnomer because in reality they are composers.
I don't think The Situation is composing. He's in with his playlist.
No. The top DJs today in the world
remixing.
No. And if they tell you, if you are a young aspiring DJ, they always tell you what is going to make you money is if you release your own music, if you compose your own electronic music using Logic or Fruity Loops, FL, whatever it is to compose your music, and then you release it, and people are going to like it. They might remix it. They might play in the clubs, and then they're going to hire you for gigs.
Mm-hmm.
And so Calvin Harris, which was the top grossing DJ, quote-unquote, really is a music composer. They don't call him composers because they call him producers, but whatever. Right. He made, according to Forbes magazine, $43 million last year. Now, of those $43 million, it's not on sales. This is the point I want to return that you made earlier about royalties. What makes musicians money these days is performance, is live performance. So these top, you know, the top DJs in the world, they're being flown around. Some of them have their own private jets.
Right.
Then they're flying all over the place. They do, for example, a show in the around 10 to 12 in L.A., and then they fly to Las Vegas, and then they do the 2 to 3 a.m. or 3 to 4 a.m. show.
I want to grab a call here from Jonathan on his cell phone. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, how are you, Colin?
Good.
I'm just I'm listening, enjoying this. I'm thinking WPKN in Bridgeport, 89.5, pretty much takes care of almost anybody in anything, in any type of music and public affairs, and it's totally listener-supported. They're two paid people, and they do an incredible job of doing the playlist for you.
Yeah, and actually, I have to say, once again, having driven to New York and back in one day, there is a certain point somewhere around the time we get around Route 8 that WPKN comes into play. And they almost always are playing something really unusual, really something special, really something different. There just aren't – there are so few of those kinds of stations anymore.
Their motto, which is some one of the programmer's kids from 25 years ago, is some songs I like, some songs I don't like, and sometimes you just have to turn it off because it's awful. But the rest of the
time—that's
a
ringing endorsement. I like it.
I have no iPod. I don't have an iPad. I have my phone, which has no music on it, and all of my radios have always been tuned to either you guys or PKN. So,
but you know that slogan speaks volumes because, in fact. And for 16 years, I worked at a station that was part of a group of radio stations that included a lot of commercial radio stations. And one of the things that they didn't ever want you to do was turn off the radio. I mean, that's why they couldn't take any chances. They could never have the slogan that WPKN has. They could never do a kind of programming where occasionally you took a chance of having somebody turn off the radio because, you know, why take that chance? And I think that's sort of maybe one of the things that we miss, too. Hey, just in order to have time for the other stuff we want to talk about, we can take a quick break here. We'll be back. We're back with The Nose as we wrap up that conversation about music and radio. Let me just speed read some tweets. Vivian, I am all about shuffling. I like to be surprised. Sometimes you'll hear a song you forgot you own. Suburban Recluse says, shuffle is a bad thing. Who wants Iron Maiden thrown between Crosby, Stills, and Nash and James Taylor? Amy is tweeting, I will forever love college radio stations and also streaming radio shows in studio music sets online from Seattle, Colorado, etc. Kevin tweets, depends on what it is. Some albums become odd when placed in shuffle, like Joe's Garage. That would be a Frank Zappa, Mothers of Invention reference, I think. And Larry Mack tweets, moved away in 1995, but I missed the college radio stations in and around Hartford. Used to follow specific DJs at WRTC and WHUS. There are more tweets coming in here. All right. So, and somebody's tweeting, KTAO in Taos is the most unique radio station in the U.S. They produce their own commercials and are just everything radio used to be. I assume they're streamable as well. All right, so we have to shift from there. We're going to take a look over at Sochi just for a second, the Olympics. One of the things that happens every single Olympic, really, and was chronicled most recently in The New Yorker, an essay that we circulated around, is this kind of obsession with emotional moments. We've got a little clip here. Probably you've heard it by now. This is Bodie Miller finishing up his ski event at which he medaled. And so an interviewer from NBC is asking him a series of questions about his emotions. Let's hear that.
Bodie, you're showing so much emotion down here. What's going through your mind?
I mean, a lot, obviously. Just a long struggle coming in here. And just a tough year. And
I know you wanted to be here with Chile, really experiencing these games. And how much does it mean to you to come up with a great performance for him? And was it for him?
I mean, I don't know if it's really for him, but I wanted to come here and I don't know, I guess make myself proud, but...
When you're looking up in the sky at the start, we see you there, and it just looks like you're talking to somebody. What's going on there? Sorry.
All right, so that's Bodie Miller. He's talking about his brother who died. His brother also a winter athlete who, in fact, was died from a seizure and was not taking his seizure-controlling medications, partly because he thought it might affect his performance a little bit. But so Carolyn Payne, there have been a lot of reactions to this, and Bodie Miller ultimately said he didn't really have a problem with it. But I could see by a certain amount of body language you were exhibiting during that clip that maybe you did have one.
I did. I know he said that he didn't blame that reporter, but I really can't help but blame her. I think that she was just pushing the buttons. And I get that's, you know, they're trying to keep their ratings up and they're trying to make everything this, like, human interest so it goes beyond sports so that, you know, the people watching who aren't necessarily really invested in the sport itself are getting invested by these people and feel something and... But I just could not believe that she went ahead and just pushed those buttons for him at that moment. Because, like, already your emotions are so high. Like, first of all, I'd be in tears just having to be on skis on the top of a mountain. And then, you know, then you get there, you win it, and it's this the wave of emotions that someone would have to be feeling at that at that point. I mean, I'd just be crying tears of joy, happiness, fear, excitement. And, you know, then to bring up something so personal and emotional, it was like, really? I did not appreciate what they did there for him.
Anybody feel like defending it?
I don't, except if it had happened in curling, I think it would have been legitimate. I could have handled that.
I'm not sure. I think that NBC manipulates all of this. Clearly, there's a whole approach that they have where they spend far too long on all these personal interest stories instead of showing the competitions. You don't see that in the broadcasting of the Olympics in other places in the world. On the other hand, if I were the journalist and I see this person crying in this situation, why not try to pursue it?
I'm going to jump on that. Yeah.
You know?
Did it remind anyone of broadcast news?
Oh, yes. The
didn't it seem very like it's just so the end is already determined?
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, a few things about this. I mean, this is a constant problem. One of the things that has been criticized is the fact that obviously none of this stuff is happening in real time. It's all happening kind of earlier in the day. We watch it at prime time, by which time NBC has had the opportunity to make a bunch of choices about it. Mm-hmm. And most of the choices they have made have not involved editing out any of that emotional binder. You know, it's sort of all in there. One of the other things that the essay we saw criticized was Lyman Currier, who's a freestyle skier who falls as he's trying to ski through this wild half-pipe skiing course. These sports, by the way, they always seemed like they were invented like 20 minutes ago. But
yeah, they should have changed.
But whatever that sport is, he got really hurt in it. And then he's lying on the ground, and he's making these kind of bleating noises, you know, like really a wounded animal. And having had a similar injury once in my life, I totally get why you make that noise. But, you know, I mean, they just sort of kept the camera on him while he made that noise. And then by 9 o'clock or so, when they'd had 6 hours to think it over, they thought it over and they thought, oh, you know, let's hear him screaming.
That was reminiscent to me of, remember that viral video Grape Lady, the news reporter who falls? She's smashing grapes and then falls down, and you don't see her, but you just hear her going, and that was what that was to me.
Yeah.
It was almost like they were, I just felt like it was a gratuitous use of.
Well, I always think when I hear an incident like the one you described, it was like when Sally Struthers was pleading for food for these starving kids, and legitimate cause and everything. But you know what? You could turn around and give them a sandwich right now.
Yeah.
Well, but let's turn this around because this conversation is all happening from the perspective of what NBC does. NBC would not be doing this every Olympic, summer or winter, if the audience would be upset by this. If they would, like you were saying before about turning off the radio, they would turn off the TV. They continue to do it because the market research, the focus group research shows that this works. So then for me, the next question is, what makes people want to see these things?
Well, I think Carolyn kind of alluded to it. Part of it is they don't know the sports very well. They don't have – and you were saying that in other countries this kind of thing isn't quite as necessary. Probably in some of these other countries, the familiarity with a whole series of Nordic sports is high enough so that people – they already have some things that they know about some biathlon competitors and maybe even know a little backstory. But they also – they can really just get into the biathlon-ness of the whole thing, whereas Americans, they don't really know very much about most of these sports. They don't think of them more often than every 2 or 4 years, really. So absent, I mean, these people aren't meaningful to Americans unless somebody explains why.
I guess they're trying to humanize them.
Well, and so
it's
in
like
the last 4 years,
is
it reality TV has spun maybe the emotions of American viewers so that they need this sort of moment of accumulation, this emotional accumulation.
I mean, I guess it's just interesting because think about, I mean, these are Olympic athletes. They do things that we definitely can't do. I mean, you could train and try to do it, but they're doing amazing things. Like, I'm watching these things and I'm thinking, oh my God, I could never, I would never want to do that and never be able to do that. And I can do some pretty incredible things.
You're a nice dancer.
The person who's speaking right now, just for context, this week put on ice skates and a red jumpsuit for some kind of comedy video and did Swiffer curling.
I fell down a lot.
And fell down a lot. So your respect for these athletes, I'm just sort of emphasizing that.
It went way up, yeah. But you're watching this and they really do. They seem like superhumans. And then to show them in a light that humanizes them, I think is an interesting tactic because it's kind of that thing that we as humans are drawn to with everyone. We like when people are more like us. We like that we're like, oh, well, they're more human. I think that that's an interesting way to understand why.
It's a price of admission, too. I mean, I Bodie Miller ordinarily is not the emotive guy they want him to be. So I'm going to make a really bizarre correlation and say there's something of inside Llewyn Davis in all this in the sense that, you know, Llewyn Davis won't emote the way that everybody wants him to. You know, he wants to sing his folk music and that's it. Mm-hmm. He's not going to smile. He's not going to shave his beard differently. He's not going to join Peter, Paul, and Mary. He pays a big price for that. It's the world has kind of decided. And Luis, I think you're probably right. We've kind of decided this is what we want, so give it to us or else.
And I think that Caroline was nailing it in the sense that we want to see these people as real humans who have similar emotions of frustration and pain and anger, depression in the context of losing or even getting injured, which is worse. But I also think that Jim nailed it as well, is that today reality TV has created what I would call emotion pornography. And so far more intensely than before people watched soap operas. Yes, that was emotion pornography. But now with reality TV, it's far more intense continuously on cable television. And I think that's part of the
thing. Perpetrated as reality.
It's presented as reality when in fact it's not. it's not. It's concocted. But I think both of you were right on the money. I mean, these are the two phenomena, I would say, that are the two major explanations.
Well, I think I can make a very nifty segue. We don't have a lot of time to talk about this. Between that, what you guys just said, and this essay written by James Franco in the New York Times a couple of days ago. It's about Shia LaBeouf, who's had a bad patch of public behavior that have involved accusations of plagiarism, followed by apologies in which he seemed to plagiarize a style of apology from somebody else. And then wearing a paper bag over his head that said, "I am not famous anymore," at a red carpet premiere of his own movie, which is called Nymphomaniac. Last week, he staged an art show called hashtag I Am Sorry that involved having him sit opposite visitors to a Los Angeles gallery while he wore a similar bag over his head and stared at them through cutout eye holes. And so, Jim, one of the things that James Franco tries to do in this piece is kind of make a similar point, which is that actors sometimes aren't in control of the public perception of them. That often is determined by the movies that they're in and how people react to the movies that they're in. And then sometimes they're sort of either penalized for being the person they appear to be in their movies or not being the person that they appear to be in their movies. And somehow or other, if they don't want to wind up like Bodie Miller, they have to sort of take back their own personality. And that's what he believes Shia LaBeouf is trying to do right now, is take control of his own image. I'll hand that.
So I wasn't sure, reading James Franco, is he defending him Or is he just sort of firing a warning shot like, dude, you know, this is rough water you're in now, so you got to you need to tighten things up a bit. As I recall, Shia LaBeouf was sort of one of the anointed ones by Steven Spielberg and a number of other people. He was a kid, and Spielberg took a liking to him. So he's been in the spotlight for a long time. And suddenly he started doing he started plagiarizing people and stuff like that and got nailed on that and just didn't know how to do something wrong or how to make an apology.
And the apology was also plagiarized.
Exactly. You know, so all of a sudden he turned into a politician instead of an actor. So I think what James Franco was saying is, you know, just go stay in your house for a while. And
well,
maybe
I think
act.
That James Franco was trying to reinterpret what he was doing as performance art. Because he did this thing of sitting on a museum.
Because
a
he's James Franco, though.
Yeah, yeah. Sitting there with a bag saying apologize and yeah. so on. But at the same time, he says, as performance art, it's a great project, but don't overdo it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's a meta thing going on because James Franco is always being parodied for his endless curiosity and all the things he could do in his performance.
And
he's, art, right?
he said the choices that he made, like joining General Hospital at a time when he was making sort of Oscar-worthy movies, was represented that kind of rebellion. I mean, significantly, Carolyn, one of the things that he does in this piece is he talks really about four different actors: himself, Shia LaBeouf, Joaquin Phoenix, and Marlon Brando. Now, Marlon Brando, I think, sort of earned the right to be this weird, uncooperative person, you know, to a greater degree than those other guys did.
Yeah, I think that the interesting thing for me was how James Franco came across in this article. I hadn't really read any of his writings yet, and then when I, you know, read this, I definitely want to read more. I want to get a little bit more inside of where his. But it was almost this. It wasn't almost. It was a very egotistical approach to
James Franco.
I know. I wasn't shocked about that. But the way he, you know, is trying to pass off that he has this older, wiser knowledge, and you know, he's like what, like 6 years, 8 years older than Shia LaBeouf, and like he just is going on about how. He needs to take some time off, and but James Franco is
he's
not one to be passing judgment.
Actually, I'm going to just cut this off just because we won't get endorsements otherwise. So just we'll just leave you with the thought that really pretty much everybody is older and wiser than Shia LaBeouf. But
I would like to friend James Franco just leave it there.
All right, maybe there'll be time for that as we come back for endorsements after this.
Pretend I'm famous. Pretend you've seen me in the street. Pretend I'm famous. And say you always hoped we'd meet. I will be gracious. I will be funny and sincere. Pretend I'm famous. Then ask me what I'm doing here.
The U.S. is playing Canada in hockey right now, and it's really important that we win. Because if we lose, we have to keep Justin Bieber. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our interns are Jane Ashley and Skylar Magnoli. Katie Tolarski is our executive producer. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. The part of Bill Curry was played by Murray the K. For show pages, articles, and vines of the Faith Middleton Show staff screaming, "Wolf! Wolf!" at a French bulldog out in the hallway, visit our website, WNPR.org. On Monday, fearless TV critic Willa Paskin joins the scramble. And now, back to Colin.
Yeah, we had somehow or other meant to include in our conversation about emotions at the Olympics and sort of stage-managed emotions at the Olympics the hoax played by Jimmy Kimmel and one Olympian that appeared to be a wolf walking around in the hallways of one of the Sochi hotels, and it was no such thing. All right, so that's what that was a reference to anyway. So we're here with Carolyn Payne, Luis Figueroa, and Jim Chapterley, and it's time for endorsements, things that they know about that maybe you'd like to know about. Carolyn, what have you got for us?
All right. The new restaurant in West Hartford, Blue Plate Kitchen, is really good, and they have wine on tap, which is really, I guess it's something that's very common out in California now, but it's awesome. So go check that out. And I also want to endorse the Lego Movie.
I heard that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
really good.
People are getting excited about it. All right.
Okay, three quick things. A book called Labyrinths of Reason. We've talked a little bit about it by William Poundstone. kind of addresses the frailties of what we actually can know or truly do know. And it's, you know, you can read a chapter at a time. And there's a book called Arguably by Christopher Hitchens, who's just a great author who you want to smash in the face sometimes, but it's pretty hard to lose, to win an argument with him. And lastly, True Detective, once again, and specifically for the way that Matthew McConaughey smokes a cigarette. And if you watch it just for that, you will come away a better person.
I feel that there's sort of two time frames in True Detective. One is the past and one is the present. And he's being interviewed by these other two detectives in the present. And that smoking that goes on in the present I find distracting. I mean, it's so horrible. It's so voracious and wolf-like in its quality.
How does he not have lung cancer by the end of 20 minutes of that,
really
each episode?
It really seems like the most self-destructive smoking I've ever seen in my life. Anyway, yeah.
All right. I'll try to run through my things very quick. A couple of endorsements. First one is a play at the Hartford Stage titled A Song for Twilight that opened last night. It was written by Noel Coward. It will run through March 16th. Again, it's a play at the Hartford Stage called A Song for Twilight. The writing, the language is just amazing. The character psychology, the plot twist, and the performances by the actors. But it's also very funny, very, very deep. I will not say what it's about because otherwise you will not enjoy it. Second, the Connecticut AIDS Coalition has its annual fundraising extravaganza on the night of the Oscar Awards. They rebranded it now as, quote, the Red Carpet Experience, and it will take place on Sunday, March 2nd, the night of the Oscars, beginning at 7 p.m., or if you pay the VIP ticket donation, you can go to the VIP reception at 6. It will be at the Spotlight Theaters on Front Street in downtown Hartford, next to the convention center. And the thing about this that I like is that people can come dressed as a character in one of the nominated movies. And that's exactly what I plan to do this year, but I will not tell you which movie. And a plug, right? Going to plugs are things that in the future. Mm-hmm. The Mark Twain House will have an exhibit beginning on March 14 at your service about servant life in the Mark Twain House, and a special nighttime tour of the servants' quarters that will begin on April 14th. Again, that's the Mark Twain House about servant life inspired by the Downton Abbey series.
Okay, I will co-endorse the Oscar Night AIDS Party. It's an event that Peter Shapiro and I started, I think, 15 years ago now. And it's always fun. And it'll be at Spotlight this year. That'll be a great place for it. So get your tickets now, though. They need to know how many people are coming because there's always great food and great things to drink and a drink named after Kion Wolf this year, I think. But they need to know how much of it to have there. So buy your tickets now. A few things that I want to endorse. It's also some plays and movies. Since we're talking about Oscars, many people think a movie called The Great Beauty is going to win the Best Foreign Language Oscar. I certainly would be pleased if it did. It's one of the truly amazing movies that I've probably ever seen. This is an Italian movie in which sort of this one 65-year-old man, this party boy who's been sort of frittering his life away instead of writing a lot of novels, takes you through the heaven and hell of Rome. It's a long movie, about 2 hours and 40 minutes, I think. It's playing at Bantam Cinemas right now. If you live anywhere out there towards Litchfield, you really ought to see this. You need to see it on a big screen, too. It's just not going to work in your home theater. Smaller movie was also shortlisted for a while for a foreign language from Chile called Gloria, about a woman sort of in her 50s. Yeah, Luis likes that too. It's playing, I think, still over on New Park Avenue and probably some other locations right now. It's a lovely movie sort of about what it's like to be a woman of a certain age and trying to and being divorced and trying to sort out one's options. And
goes out dancing.
And so, yes, a lot of dancing. And then lastly, playing here right now at the Bushel, Peter and the Starcatcher. I did not expect to like this as much as I did. It is as if the Marx Brothers and Monty Python collaborated on a sort of prequel to Peter Pan. There's a guy named John Sanders who is turning in a real virtuoso comedy performance as the villain, Black Stash. He's worth the price of admission anyway, but it really is one of those funnier than necessary shows in which joke after joke after joke just piles on with incredible physical comedy. I was truly amazed. Comes out of the New York Theater Workshop, which is also where Once originated, the musical version of Once, which will be down at the Schubert in New Haven next week, and where I just saw What's It All About, Bacharach Reimagined, one of the most incredible things I've seen in a long time. But that's closing. I can't endorse that right now. But anyway, go see Peter and the Starcatcher. A few nights left there at the Bushnell. You'll have a good time.
Kyone Wolf, you just won the gold in the downhill curling biathlon. How do you feel?
You know, I just couldn't get my dead cat Momo out of my mind the whole time. I miss his little face, you know?
Whoa. Don't cry. Here, have a Hot Pocket.
Oh, thanks, man. I feel a lot better.